The faculty panel session is, of course, one of the highlights of the Mises University, where you get to ask questions of your professors, instructors here this week. The way it's set up in the schedule is a little off. We're going to go from 4 o'clock to 4:45 discussing policy questions here. And then we're going to take a 15-minute break where you'll have the opportunity to either stay here for more questions on policy or maybe the same questions on policy, or to go downstairs to the theory section. And then we'll be reconvened for another 45 minutes. We have written questions that we'll begin with, but after we get through those, you can ask questions from the floor. And again, this is the policy section of the faculty panel, so they should be primarily policy-oriented questions, although we'll get what we can take, or we'll take what we can get. Okay. And you can direct your oral questions or written questions to specific professors or to the panel as a whole. The first question, how does Austrian theory deal with the neoclassical curiosity of Giffen goods?
It's supposed to be the policy session. It's a theory question.
Why, thank you. Yeah, this doesn't sound like a policy question to me, but let's see, how should I answer that? To my knowledge, none of the founding Austrians or earlier generation of Austrians addressed this issue specifically. Rothbard doesn't deal directly with Giffen goods in Man, Economy, and State. There have been some previous discussions on... Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Is this on? Okay, so the question is about so-called Giffen goods, G-I-F-F-E-N. That is an obscure, it's a commodity that has been proposed or hypothesized by, well, first by a famous, not so famous, an English economist named Robert Giffen, and it's discussed in some of the neoclassical economics textbooks. And I guess without going into too much detail, as some of you, if you've taken an intermediate microeconomic theory course, a mainstream course, you know that it's common to talk about price changes and the effects of price changes on quantities demanded in terms of separate income and substitution effects. So the so-called Giffen good is a good that has particular, in which the income effect is particularly strong and outweighs the substitution effect, the result of which is supposed to be that you get an upward sloping demand curve. So the claim of the, some of the textbooks will say, well, most demand curves are downward sloping, but it's theoretically possible that you could have a really weird case where the demand curve is upward sloping. And the kind of example that they've typically given is a commodity that is like a staple food that very poor people buy. And the idea is, take potatoes, for example. So you have these Irish peasants in the 19th century, let's say, who mostly eat potatoes. And the claim is, well, if the price of potatoes were to go down, well, because these poor people spend most of their income on potatoes, they would not have to spend as much to sustain themselves as they would before. So their real income, in effect, has gone up. When the price of one of the major things they consume goes down, their sort of purchasing power has gone up. Therefore, they would start spending more money on other things they couldn't afford before, like meat. So they would actually start buying less potatoes. They would buy fewer potatoes and more meat as a result of the price of potatoes going down. And normally we say that when the price of a good goes down, other things equal, the quantity demanded goes up. But the Giffen good claim is that you could have under certain special conditions, the price of the good could go down and the quantity demanded would also go down. Okay, so the demand curve would have the wrong shape. Probably the motivation of the question, I don't know if the person who asked the question is here. They're downstairs. Do we get all the theory questions? Maybe the piles got mixed up. But they say, well, you Austrians claim that things like the law of demand are, in Mises terminology, right, praxeological truths. They're not just empirical tendencies or generalizations, but you can prove that all demand curves are downward sloping, and yet, what about the Irish potatoes and this exception, that exception? Now, two ways to think about that. One is empirically, most neoclassical economists will say, yeah, I can see how that's theoretically possible, but I doubt that anything like that ever happened in reality, so let's just forget about it. An alternative approach, and one that Joe Salerno and I are writing a paper on this. The paper's not available for circulation just yet. Yeah, it's a plug, actually. I think you can show in a fairly straightforward fashion, if you follow the kind of price theory of Karl Menger that was adopted by von Baverk and Mises and Rothbard, that it's a completely different approach in which there are no distinct income and substitution effects, and in which a given good is a theoretical impossibility. So basically this is a question about differences between the neoclassical understanding of demand theory and the Austrian understanding. And I'll just leave you with the claim that the Austrian version is not just a non-mathematical representation or non-mathematical rendition of neoclassical demand theory as you get from Hicks or Samuelson, but it's really a very different way to think about demand. And if you go back to Herbner's not here, but Jeff Herbner gave a nice treatment of kind of the basics of utility and value theory. If you follow in that lines, if follow along those lines, all demand curves are downward sloping.
My colleague Bill Barnett and I are working on several papers on this also, and one of the things we note is that Mises never used demand curves, and the idea behind our research is that demand curves themselves are illegitimate, because when you have a demand curve, there's only supposed to be one thing changing, price falls and quantity rises, but absolutely necessarily, other things have to change too. Say wealth has to change as you move along the curve. Now, there are ways of trying to get out of this wealth effect. There's the Hicks, there's the several other ways, scalloping an indifference curve. But even if you do the scalloping of an indifference curve kind of way, then the ratio of the marginal utilities is changing. So something is changing. So the demand curve itself is illegitimate. And if the demand curve itself is illegitimate, then there ain't no Giffen good, because that's predicated on a demand curve. So it's a different way. It's supportive of what Joe and Peter are doing, but it's a different take.
Here's two questions from the same individual, and they're related, so I'm going to combine them. Would congressional term
limits be more or less conducive to limited government than the current system, and would a higher proportion of representatives per citizen be more or less conducive to limited government than the current proportion? Basically, what we found is that term limits don't really do much in terms of limiting government, but increasing the proportion of representatives to the citizens actually is somewhat conducive to some limits on government, in the sense that if you have more representatives per citizen, they're going to be more representative of the citizens' interest rather than of special interest, and the interest of individuals tends to be of more limited government. If we had the same proportion of congressmen to citizens as we did when the country was founded, we'd have 9,000 congressmen. So government wouldn't be limited in that sense, but the budget would be. Anybody else? No?
What was the answer?
I know, it sounds scary, doesn't it?
What does a congressman do day by day? Plots to plunder us. And so I'm not sure if they worked out that well, that we had 9,000 instead of 500.
It might be harder to form coalitions and so on. So. They might spend more time.
I'm not so sure about each other.
It's certainly not a cure-all, that's for sure.
Necessarily bigger than 435, but that is bigger government.
Okay. How are we supposed to turn policy theories such as privatization into practice? Is it the case of electing libertarians into office, or as Austrian economists, do we need to invade policy centers and change it from the inside? Basically, what action must we take to see things, see the changes we want?
Austrian economists have no view on that whatsoever. Austrianism is a value-free subject. It tries to understand reality. This is a question of libertarianism, of how do we do things. So,
which you have an opinion, no doubt.
Well, I have opinions on this stuff, but I think the more important point is to distinguish between Austrian economics, which is a value-free subject, and libertarianism or any other political philosophy, which is an attempt to do things, as in this case, privatize. Okay, so let's change the question to, you know, drop the Austrianism from there. I don't think there's any one right way. Uncle Mao said, let 1,000 flowers bloom. Let's all move to, what is it, New Hampshire for this free state project. Let's vote for the Libertarian Party if Bob Barr isn't running. Let's vote for Ron Paul, obviously. The Ron Paul, Andrew Napolitano ticket would be a very nice ticket. Support the Mises Institute. Support Loyola University New Orleans because we have the highest proportion of Austro-libertarians on our economics staff. There are lots of ways that Patry Friedman has this idea of, you know, setting up something in the middle of the ocean, which has been tried before. I'm not a real big fan of that, but that's one more alternative that could be mentioned.
So you got two questions there.
Okay, I'll be really quick. Unlike Peter Klein, the... Yeah. Okay. So Walter is correct that it's not, there isn't some pronouncement that, oh, well, you know, clearly because of the action axiom, this is the proper strategy we should all employ. Those are totally different things. I just want to share my personal experience. I was disillusioned. I was working for a think tank on the West Coast, and they had me do a flat tax paper. And so right off the bat, I was actually advocating raising taxes on certain people because the California income tax code is very so-called progressive, and they want it to be revenue neutral. So the idea was they're saying to me, come up with a flat tax that's going to be more efficient, blah, 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 which it, you know, would have been on several criteria, but it needs to raise the same amount of revenue assuming the economy is the same size. So necessarily the people who were taxed at the bottom, you know, this was going to raise their taxes. So that was one thing that I didn't feel good about, but, you know, I went ahead and did it. And then a congressperson, so not a federal one, but a state level one, loved the paper. And he called me into his office and he wanted to, you know, let's implement. This is great. So I'm feeling real important. You know, just the being near power was like sort of, you know, giving me woozy. And, and I'm talking to the guy and he was fired up. I mean, he was not like schmoozing or whatever. I mean, he really believed it, and he was smart too. He understood why it worked. He had read the paper and he understood the logic. And his chief of staff, we were there for like 45 minutes. In the beginning, he was all fired up, this politician. By the end of the meeting, it was, okay, well, let's stay in touch and, you know, we'll get in touch with you and we'll let you know. And it was clear that was it. Now, and what happened is the chief of staff told him truthfully that, you know, boss, this isn't going to even get out of committee. You're just going to stick your neck out. The Republicans are going to kill this, and the public, you're not going to get any gain whatsoever, and you're just going to be a radical, and you're going to get the, you know, the whip mad at you or whatever. So I'm saying it wasn't that the chief of staff was out to get me and he was a closet Keynesian either. He was just explaining the logic, the incentives that his boss faced. There was no benefit in him trying to push this thing through, and so it just died. So I was very disillusioned.
There was this great TV show, Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister, and one of the bad things is to be courageous. To be courageous in starting a new policy, it means, you know, you just get cut off at the knees.
Oh. I don't have anything to say. I just wanted to see Mark run across the back. Well, all I'll say is most people think horizontally about this sort of government reform. That is, if only we can get our guy in, if only we can get Ron Paul elected president, which would be a great thing, then we have a chance to privatize and all this. But Tom Woods and I think vertically sometimes. In other words, the devolution of power away from the center is also important, as opposed to whether we have a flat tax or a semi-flat tax or, you know, particular policies. But, you know, how did we get in this big mess? It's centralized governmental power that began its push in the late 19th century all over the world, Russia, Germany, America, and all the other countries. And that's where we've got monopolistic government that is just one big plundering machine. And so to reverse that, it takes the opposite. It takes the devolution of power. That's why, you know, Tom's book, Nullification, is right on that kind of thinking, the idea, whole idea of secession. How did the Soviet Empire implode? Peaceful secession. That's how. And then so you have some countries like Estonia that seem to be much freer than other former Soviet republics are as far as that goes. And so it's a real experiment in federalism, the American idea of federalism going on in the former Soviet Empire. And so, so hopefully I'd like to see us talk about the former American Empire someday with the same sort of thing, maybe 10 or 15 or 50 different republics rather than just having 9,000 politicians ruling over us in the same old centralized state. Now, I think Bob had
Well, speaking of that, I've got two questions here on the same subject by different people. First, can local governments attempt to nullify unconstitutional state and or federal laws? And two, do you like the idea of towns and cities nullifying state and federal laws? Anybody on the panel want to address that?
Well, yes, but there would be one argument that they can't use that states can use. States can use the so-called compact theory of the union to say that, you know, the states created the federal government, so they are the principals to the contract, and there's no impartial arbiter for disputes between the agent and the principals, so therefore the principals have to decide for themselves if the Constitution has been violated. Towns don't have that because the towns didn't create the states and so on and on. But you still have other arguments. You can still have moral arguments, still have self-government arguments, still have leave-me-the-heck-alone arguments. I mean, all kinds of arguments you can use other than that. So, yeah, I think we should keep it as local as possible. And what was the other thing? I was just hearing about this. Oh, yeah. I was talking to Gary North the other day. He has got this clever trick that I copied from him, which is you buy a domain name that is easy to say and memorable – that then redirects to your own site and redirects to a page on your own site so that you don't have to say, oh, listen, I have a great article for you. Go to tomwoods.com/articles/whatever. Yeah, forget it. Right? It's never going to happen. So you have something. So his thing is countyrights.com. Type that in, countyrights.com, and bang, you wind up at Gary North's site. He's got a page there. And he says, because he was telling me, you know, nullification, state nullification is for sissies. He says, what we need is at the county level, we need these sheriffs to say to the federal agents, no, you can't come in because I'm the sheriff and I'm the chief constitutional officer here and you can't come in. He says, that's what we need. And if we're going to make any progress, it's going to occur from the ground up. So on that page, it says, I am holding the domain name countyrights.com for Sarah Palin. She has until December 31st, 2010. If she really wants to do something other than just be a hack, now I inserted that part because he didn't put that in there, but he says if she really wants to do something, she will pursue something along the lines of county rights. And if she wants to do it, I will hand her this domain name. I don't think that's going to happen, but it's worth looking at anyway.
I think Hans Hoppe's book, Democracy, the God That Failed, I think that's where he said it. He made the case for independent cities, thinking in terms of the devolution of power, not so much states' rights or something like that, but cities. And he talks about how this was true in antiquity. And so if you want to really read up on this, it's sort of a footnote to what Tom just said. That's where to find it.
Okay, this next question I didn't particularly like, but I thought we needed to air it anyways. Women are outnumbered 5-1 at the Mises Institute, which I think is incorrect. Are the institute's restroom facilities designed to accommodate the difference? And what I wanted to know. And what I wanted to know is which one of you guys have been sneaking around in the women's bathrooms? Actually, a lot of the facilities of the Institute were designed by women. Okay. All week we have talked about different areas in which government should not be involved, including national defense. It seems as though the Austrians would favor anarchy before any government inducement. If this is untrue, then please define the role of government according to the Austrian perspective.
Tim hasn't had a chance.
Oh, all right. Yeah, go ahead. Lovely. Okay. Well, again, I think this is a libertarian versus Austrian economics kind of question. And Austrian economics would have to, I think, defer to libertarianism on policy questions. And I think the consistent libertarian would have to say that government does not have an ethical right to coerce, does not have that ethical right to use aggression any more than a highway robber would. There's a lot here in Rothbard that you can go back and look at, and it's just volumes and volumes of material explaining how not only the ethical reasons for this. You can look at the Ethics of Liberty, for example, not only the ethical foundation for an anarcho-capitalism, but also how it might work practically in some cases. I had somebody ask me this week, well, how do you think such and such would work in a free market system? And frankly, my answer has to be, I have no idea. We are so far from a free market system that I have trouble. There's so many things that would have to change. I have trouble imagining what it might be like. Now, we can propose certain things. Dr. Block has mentioned privatizing the road system and has written some things on how that might work. But we really have to acknowledge that so much of what we now see is non-libertarian, that the changes would be far beyond our view.
You know, another way that the question could be asked is, what have important Austrian economists historically thought about the proper role of government? And it's worth pointing out that even though today the Austrian school is typically associated with very radical libertarianism, that wasn't the case for most of its history. Menger and Bombawerk and most of the early Austrians were more or less, 19th century classical liberals in the same mold as the British classical school, Adam Smith and Ricardo and Mill and so on. There were some exceptions. F.A. Wieser, who was Bombawerk's brother-in-law and Menger's other important student, was a socialist, more or less, who thought that the theory of diminishing marginal utility justified progressive income taxation. Some of the other people, early 20th century Austrians, Filipovic was mentioned by Guido Hulsmann, was much more of a kind of interventionist. Mises was a classical liberal. Hayek was a classical liberal who went quite a bit further than Mises in support for various forms of government intervention in the economy. Rothbard was the anarcho-capitalist radical individualist, but he was rather unique in that regard. And because of Rothbard's, brilliant insights and tremendous scholarship, both as a anarcho-capitalist political theorist and as an Austrian economist, these two ideas have come to be very closely associated. But it isn't necessarily isn't a necessary connection, at least historically speaking.
I wanted to add to that, Richard Ebeling and Joe Salerno are very good at history of thought, as is Peter. And they tell me that there were several Nazis, you know, absolute Nazis in Austria and in Germany who were Austrian economists but were Nazis. So you can't infer or deduce economic freedom from Austrianism. They're two very separate things. One is normative and one is positive, and never the twain shall meet. As Peter says, it's under the Rothbardian influence that so many people conflate it, but it's not conflatable, or it need not be conflated. They're very different things. To talk about the Austrian business cycle theory or why indifference is a problem is a very different kind of a thing than saying, you know, liberty is a good thing. One can hold various views on either of them. It's only because of the Rothbardian influence, I think, that in the public mind, to be an Austrian is to be an anarcho-capitalist. It need not be.
I'll add some readings for those of you who are interested in this. You know, most people tend to equate anarchy with chaos or something bad. But there's a famous article in the Journal of Libertarian Studies, 1979, called The Not-So-Wild Wild West by Terry Anderson and P.J. Hill, about what it was like in the American frontier before there was any government out there. And it was much more peaceful than any American city today, for example. The cowboy movies got it all wrong. And then also there's a book, Bruce Benson wrote a book on the privatization of law, and he talks about what happened, how people policed themselves before there were police departments on the American frontier, and they were doing a pretty good job privately, and then the government comes and takes over and crime shoots up. So you could actually read real history about what these anarcho-capitalist societies were like. There's another one called Order Without Law by Brian Ellickson about how ranchers in Northern California get along and solve all sorts of externality problems and roaming cows on the highways and things without any kind of laws. It's all private agreement. So there is a literature on this, and you shouldn't just automatically think that the word anarchy means chaos and all that sort of thing. And so I would recommend those readings.
Next question. How are organizations such as the National Football League able to thrive despite collectivist measures such as revenue sharing and unionism? I begin by noting that football leagues and baseball leagues and things like that are not collectivist. They're cooperative and contractual, and that it's a unit working for, obviously, for the profit of each individual firms, but it's much the same like McDonald's, where you have a central corporation along with a bunch of franchises, and there are lots of rules, regulations, and so forth, requirements on the part of both types of parties, the central corporation and the franchises themselves.
This attack on collectivism is a vestige of Ayn Randianism, and it's one that I'm not a big fan of. I don't see anything wrong with collectivism or cooperativism or anything like that. The key is it voluntary or not? There's the kibbutz, the commune, the nunnery, various groups that act in a collective way. I mean, the typical American family operates on the grounds of from each according to his ability to each according to his need. The three-year-old girl doesn't eat in accordance with her ability to provide income, rather in accordance with her need. The idea here is that if you take this to the logical conclusion, and I'm a big fan of reductios, then individual sports like handball or tennis or track or swimming would be good, whereas collectivist sports, team sports, would be bad, like basketball, football, baseball. But that's just plain silly. There's nothing anti-libertarian about a collectivist sport, a team sport like football or baseball or basketball. Now,
you wouldn't go so far as to advocate soccer, though.
Well, that's why they call me Walter Moderate Block. Now, as to unions, unions are a complex sort of a thing. As a libertarian, you can't say per se that unions are evil. It depends upon what they do. If they limit themselves to a collective walkout altogether, then they're legitimate because there's no requirement that they shouldn't leave. There's no reason that they shouldn't monopolize in that sense. On the other hand, there are no extant unions that are like that, but there are theoretical platonic unions that could be legitimate. Most of them, I think all of them, in addition to having mass walkouts, also will invade scabs, replacement workers, and use violence against them, whether physical violence or trying to get the cops to do the violence for them through Taft-Hartley or Wagner Acts or what have you. So with regard to unions, they are possibly legitimate, but none. There are no extant examples of legitimacy. And this thing about collectivism, I'm not a big fan of that. It comes to mind, Rand, she always hated collectivism and loved individualism, but that's not the libertarian distinction. Libertarian distinction is coercion versus non-coercion, not individualism versus collectivism.
Okay. How do the insights of the new institutional economics impact the policy recommendation of Rothbard's How and How Not to Desocialize, which also applies to the USA Today? In other words, does rapid change create a sort of institutional vacuum with its own set of problems? How could we deal with this?
I guess he's handing this to me because that was the subject of one of my talks on Wednesday. But no, I don't have an answer to that. Let me see the question again. I didn't totally understand the question. Yeah, because I want to know what the answer is. I mean, the question refers to one of Rothbard's articles on, it's called How and How Not to Desocialize, where this was written in the early 90s, right after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of Eastern Europe and the breakup of the Soviet Empire and so on. And Rothbard's just pointing out that most political theorists had not given much thought to transition issues. So even if you agree that, a centrally planned economy cannot calculate and so on, and that private property ownership is more economically efficient, what if you have a society that has been that has had central government ownership of the means of production for many, many decades? How do you actually privatize it? So do you issue ownership share? So you have, the Soviet factory. Do you give each worker in the factory a share and then let him trade the shares? Does the state simply sell off the factory to the highest bidder, which could include foreign investors? I mean, there are a number of different means for getting from A to B. And Rothbard had some interesting thoughts on what he thought would be the most effective and what he thought was the most morally defensible means of getting from a status to sort of a capitalist system. I don't know specifically what insights the new institutional economics would offer, other than, of course, that when we talk about a free market society, we do have in mind certain kind of we have in mind an institutional background of security of property rights, security of person and property, the freedom to engage in trade, and so on. What particular political, legal, social institutions are most conducive to that? Well, I mean, we've been talking about that all week. Different ways to get a private property regime. You could have Murphy's anarcho-capitalism that was discussed in the previous lecture. There are different minarchist proposals for how you would do that. But other than that, I'm not sure what the NIE specifically would have to say about it.
Is the person who asked the question here?
Oh, you.
I mean, the question is about the speed of change, that Rothbard preferred rapid change to gradual change. I mean, the kind of thing Rothbard had in mind was, and actually this is probably a Walter Block question, but if you imagine some unjust arrangement, you have a person is unjustly enslaved, you have a slave and a master, and some radical abolitionist comes along and says, well, this is really not right. Slavery is immoral. The slave should be freed. And the slave master says, yeah, I agree with you, but I mean, look, I've got this whole plantation thing set up. If I were to free all my slaves right away, things would be kind of messy and it would take a while for me to figure out how to hire free labor instead. And my production would go down and GDP would fall. And yeah, I see your point, but we need to do it gradually. You know, that's not going to be much consolation for the slave, right? And I think Rothbard was making the point that it's important to remove unjust government controls quickly, even if it means there's a period of disruption. It wouldn't be justified to slow things down just to try to preserve existing arrangements if they're unjust.
Let me add to that. One of the problems with Hayek and his Road to Serfdom is that he wants to phase out rent control over 10 or 15 years. And Peter makes the point that if you have the power to end slavery or end rent control and you don't use it, in a sense, you're supporting it. Another point that Rothbard makes is that like if Ron Paul gets in, he should start getting rid of things right away, because otherwise you allow the forces of reaction to come in. I mean, if you wait and you wait, then forces get built up to stop you from doing that. So you might as well, you know, get it all done right away. And I think if Ron Paul were elected, he would not just sit around and wait and phase things out over 15 years, but he would do it over, you know, 15 hours or 15 days or something like that.
I think Hayek, though, he did recommend freezing the money supply as soon as you got into office, based on the idea that by the time the election rolled around, all the problems would be over with. We have a couple more questions, sort of individual nature, like what should I invest in and what my career should be, but these guys would not be of any help for you on that. So so let's open the floor to see if we have any questions from the floor. First question back there.
Well, there wouldn't be any Milton Friedman-like school vouchers. There would be total privatization. And it wouldn't necessarily be homeschooling. I mean, homeschooling is sort of like home carpentry. It violates the law of specialization and division of labor. I mean, I can see why people have to do it, because there are no public schools that are any good, and even private schools are a problem, so you have to homeschool. But that's not the ideal. The ideal would be private schools that would be susceptible to customer desires. So I think Murray would be very clear that we would just privatize root and branch.
One small addendum to that is one of the confusions in public debates about education is this idea, this treatment of, you know, education as a homogeneous good. You know, you either have education or you don't. It's a lot like healthcare, right? That, well, we have to make sure that everyone has access to healthcare. Well, what is healthcare? I mean, that's different things to different people. It's a composite of different procedures and medications and health-related things. The point with education is, presumably in a purely privatized educational system, if the state were not involved in any way in education, there's no reason to think that there would only be one model. You know, 12 years of secondary school followed by, you know, primary and secondary school followed by a 4-year college education where you take these classes, you learn these subjects in this way with this many kids sitting in front of a teacher doing XYZ. I mean, we have these very standardized models that have been imposed on us from above. But my conjecture is, in a free market for education, you'd have a huge variety of different kinds of things. Some people would go to, you might have formal classrooms like you have today. You might have all kinds of other, you know, what they call experiential learning, large classes, small classes, different kinds of subjects. Some people would go to school for just a short period. Some people would be in school a longer period. I mean, this idea that...
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. When people think, well, how would you have education in a free market? Or wouldn't only rich people get to go to school and poor people wouldn't? Well, when people ask that question, they think of school as a predefined thing, and they know exactly what it looks like, and everybody has to get the exact same thing, which, of course, is silly. It doesn't apply to housing or shoes or food or recreation or any other activity.
Rothbard has a monograph downstairs for sale. It's called Education Free and Compulsory, and it's a real eye-opener. Second question. Well, there certainly is some differences of opinion. What's the name of that book?
Against Intellectual Monopoly, is that what it's called? What
yeah. Against Intellectual Monopoly.
Yeah, I was wondering if there's anything beyond that.
It's against intellectual property.
No, it's just against monopoly.
Kinsella has an article on Mises.org a few days ago where he talks about libertarians still on the other side of the issue of him. So if you want to know, that's really the answer to the whole question. So he takes on the argument of the people who are still libertarians in defending intellectual property, patents and so forth. So that's, you know, I think it was Monday or Tuesday. It was on Mises.org.
You know, I mean, there's Kinsella's book and any number of Kinsella's 8,362 articles on Mises.org will give you all the latest information. But, I mean, it's interesting. This has become such a hot debate because prior to Kinsella's book, almost all free market types supported some kind of legal protection for ideas. Rothbard supported copyrights but not patents. Rand supported copyrights and patents. I mean, really nobody had actually given it that much thought, I think. But now it seems like, just anecdotally, I think the majority of free market thinkers I talk to are IP skeptics, are sort of over on the Kinsella side. But there's a lot of debate and back and forth, particularly on blogs and websites. I don't know how many book-length treatments there are, except for Kinsella's and the one by Boldrin and Levine.
Well, obviously, we don't have a crystal ball. We don't know. So if you're saying, is it theoretically possible that this could continue? It depends what you mean by what our current policy is and what you mean by continuing, right? So if you're asking a prediction, I think what they're going to keep doing is every time a crisis comes up, the Fed will just keep monetizing it, print up a new $1 trillion because, hey, the first time nothing bad happened. They can't just keep papering over. We know there are underlying real disturbances. It screws up the structure of production to have a 0% interest rate. And yes, that is going to come to a head. They can't just keep postponing it. Just like Greenspan didn't really fix things by papering over the dot-com crash. You just set up the housing boom. So that's what I think is going to happen. And also, I'm going to blog it soon. We're just scanning it in. There's a great thing. Mike McKay's here. He gave this thing from the IMF where they have this great chart, this eerie chart showing the stages to lead to a global currency. And so it's very like a conspiracy theory. It's like the blueprints from the Death Star that he smuggled out from the IMF. and it's really, so in other words, I don't just think Bernanke's bumbling along and that this thing's going to surprise. I mean, if you are thinking there are forces that are trying to move towards regional currencies, what they're doing right now, it's like, oh, maybe that's what makes sense. Because right now, what I keep stressing to people is Austrians think Bernanke's nuts, but so do Keynesians and so do monetarists. In other words, what he's doing right now, his specific combination, like he injects all that money, but then he pays banks not to make loans with the interest on reserves. It doesn't make any sense according to standard schools of thought. But if you're real sinister and think there's something else at play, well, then there's more logic to it.
Okay, you can come back here at 5 o'clock or go downstairs to Condon. Thank you, guys.